What you want, that's shut you up, hasn't it, you imbecile? Listen, I've made my inquiries. I'm sly, too, you know. She's lovely. She's good. It's not true about the Lancer. She's made heaps of lint. She's a gem. She adores you. If you had died, there would have been three of us. Her beer would have accompanied mine. I had a strong notion, as soon as you were better, to plant her right here at your bedside, but it's only in novels that one sticks young girls without further ado by the beds of the pretty wounded lads they've got their eye on. It's just not done. What would your aunt have said? You were quite naked three-quarters of the time, my good man. Ask Nicolette, who wouldn't leave you for a second if she had anything to do with it. And then, what would the doctor have said? A pretty girl doesn't cure a fever. In the end, everything's fine. Let's not talk about it any further. It's said, it's done, it's taken care of. She's yours. Such is my ferocity. You see, I saw that you didn't love me. And I said, what can I do to make that particular animal love me? I said, hold on. I've got my little Cosette at hand. I'll give her to him. Then he'll have to love me a little or tell me why not. You thought the old boy was going to kick up a stink, raise the roof, shout no, and raise my cane, and shake it at love's young dream. Not a bit of it. Cosette, well and good. Love, well and good. I ask nothing more, monsieur. Do take the trouble to marry yourself off. Be happy, my dear beloved boy. That said, the old man burst into tears, and he took Marius's head and cradled it with both arms against his breast, and they both wept. This is one of the ultimate forms of happiness.
Father, cried Marius. Ah, so you do love me after all, cried the old man.
There was an ineffable moment. They choked and could not speak. Finally the old man stammered, there you are then. He finally said it. He called me father. Marius pulled his head away from his grandfather and said softly,
but, father, now that I'm doing so well, it seems to me I could be allowed to see her.
That's taken care of, too. You'll see her tomorrow.
Father.
What?
Why not today?
Well, today then. Today it is. You called me father three times. That's got to be worth that much. I'll see to it. She shall be brought to you. It's taken care of, I tell you. This has already been set to verse. It's the denouement of the elegy in André Chénier's Les Jeunes Malades. The André Chénier, who had his throat cut by the bastard, by the giants of 93.
Monsieur Gillenormand thought he saw a slight frown on Marius's brow, though Marius, we have to say, was actually no longer listening to him, floating off as he was in ecstasy with his mind a lot more on Cosette than on 1793. The grandfather, trembling at having introduced André Chénier so clumsily, rushed on.
His throat cut is not the right way to put it. The fact is that the great revolutionary geniuses, who were not bad men, that is incontestable, who were heroes, heavens, found that André Chénier embarrassed them a bit, and so they had him guillotined. That is to say, those great men, on the 7th of Thermidor, in the interests of public safety, begged André Chénier to be good enough to...
Monsieur Gillenormand could not go on. His own sentence stuck in his throat, and not being able to either finish it or retract it while his daughter fluffed up Marius's pillow behind him, overcome by such surges of emotion, the old man hurled himself out of the bedroom as fast as his age would allow him, slammed the door shut behind him, and, purple in the face, choking, foaming at the mouth, his eyes popping out of his head, found himself nose to nose with the honest Basque, who was polishing boots in the antechamber. He grabbed Basque by the collar and shouted furiously right in his face,
by the 100,000 javots of the devil, those brigands assassinated him!
Who, monsieur?
André Chénier!
Yes, monsieur, said Basque, appalled.
Mademoiselle Gillenormand winds up deciding it is not such a bad thing that Monsieur Fauchelevent came with something under his arm. Cosette and Marius saw each other again. How this meeting went, we will refrain from saying. There are things we should not try to depict, among others, the sun. The whole family, including Basque and Nicolette, were gathered together in Marius's room when Cosette came in. She appeared at the door. She looked as though she were standing in a luminous cloud of mist. At precisely that moment,
The grandfather was about to blow his nose. He stopped short, kept his nose in his handkerchief, and eyed Cosette over the top of it.
"Adorable!" he cried.
Then he loudly blew his nose. Cosette was intoxicated, rapt, frightened, in seventh heaven. She was also as terrified as a person can be by happiness. She stuttered, pale as anything, red as anything, wanting to throw herself into Marius' arms, yet not daring to, ashamed to love openly in front of all these people. People are merciless with happy lovers, hanging around when lovers most want to be alone. Lovers have no need of people at all. With Cosette behind her, a white-haired man had come, looking grave, yet smiling, but with a small, heartbreaking smile. It was Monsieur Fauchelevent, otherwise known as Jean Valjean. He was very well decked out, as the porter had said, entirely dressed in black and in new clothes with a white cravat. The porter would never in a blue moon have guessed that this upstanding bourgeois, most likely a notary, was the terrifying man hauling cadavers who had loomed at his door on the night of June 7th, in rags, covered in mud, hideous, haggard, his face caked in blood and muck, supporting the unconscious Marius by the armpits. Yet his porter's nose was aroused. When Monsieur Fauchelevent turned up with Cosette, the porter could not help saying to his wife in private,
"I don't know why, but I can't help feeling I've seen that face somewhere before."
Monsieur Fauchelevent, in Marius's room, stood back from the others, as though aloof, close to the door. He had under his arm a parcel not unlike an octavo volume wrapped in paper. The wrapping paper was greenish and looked moldy. "Does that gentleman always go about with books under his arm like that?" Mademoiselle Gillenormand asked Nicolette in a low voice. She did not like books.
"Well,"
answered Monsieur Gillenormand, who had heard her in the same low tone,
"he's a savant. What of it? He can't help it. Monsieur Boulard, whom I knew, never walked around without a book either, and that way he always had a book close to his heart."
And bowing, he said out loud, "Monsieur Tranchelevent." Father Gillenormand did not do it deliberately, but inattention to proper names was an aristocratic way of his.
"Monsieur Tranchelevent, I have the honor of asking you on behalf of my grandson, the Baron Marius Pontmercy, for Mademoiselle's hand."
Monsieur Tranchelevent inclined his head.
"Enough said," said the grandfather,
and turning to Marius and Cosette, with both arms opened wide in blessing, he cried,
"Permission granted to adore each other."
Those two did not need to be told twice. Too bad about the crowd. The cooing began. They whispered to each other, Marius leaning forward on his chaise longue, Cosette standing close by him.
"Oh, my God," murmured Cosette, "I can't believe I'm seeing you again. It is you. It is you, monsieur. Fancy going off and fighting like that. What on earth for? It's horrible. For 4 months I was dead. Oh, it was so spiteful of you to have been in that battle. What did I ever do to you? I forgive you, but you needn't think you'll be doing anything like that again. A moment ago, when they told us to come over, I thought I was going to die again, but this time of joy. I was so sad. I didn't take the time to dress properly. I must look a fright. Whatever will your family say, seeing me with a collar all crumpled? Well, say something. You're letting me do all the talking. We're still in the Rue de l'Homme Armé. It seems that your shoulder was in a terrible state. They told me you could have put your fist inside, and then it seems they cut the flesh with scissors. That was so awful. I cried so much, my eyes have disappeared. It's funny how you can suffer like that. Your grandfather looks so nice. Don't move, don't lean on your elbow. Careful, you'll hurt yourself. Oh, I'm so happy. So our troubles are over. I'm quite giddy. There are all sorts of things I wanted to tell you, but I can't remember any of them. Do you still love me? We live at the Rue de l'Homme Armé. It doesn't have a garden. I made lint all the time. Here, monsieur, see, it's all your fault. I've got calluses on my fingers."
"Angel," crooned Marius. Angel is the only word in the language that can't be worn out. No other word could resist the merciless use that those in love put it to. Then, as there were other people present, they broke off and did not say another word to each other, merely touching each other's hand gently. Monsieur Gillenormand turned to all those in the room and shouted,
"Talk among yourselves, the rest of you. Make some noise over there in the wings. Come on, a bit of hubbub, for heaven's sake, so these children can yap at their ease."
And going over to Marius and Cosette, he said to them in a very low voice,
"Call each other, too. Don't be embarrassed."
Aunt Gillenormand watched this eruption of light in her quaint old home in amazement. Her amazement had nothing aggressive about it. It was not in the least the scandalized, envious attitude of an owl gazing upon two turtle doves. Hers was the dazed eye of a poor innocent of 57. It was life that had missed out gazing on that triumph, love.
"Mademoiselle Gillenormand, the elder,"
her father said to her,
"I told you this would happen."
He remained silent for a moment before adding,
"Look at the happiness of others."
Then he turned to Cosette.
"She's so pretty, she's so pretty. She's a Greuze. So you're going to have this all to yourself then, you cheeky rascal. Ah, young scallywag. You've got off lightly with me, you're happy, but if I were 15 years younger, we'd cross swords to see who'd get her. Come now, I am in love with you, mademoiselle. That's only natural, it's your right. Ah, what a beautifully pretty, charming little wedding this is going to be. Saint-Denis du Saint-Sacrement is our parish, but I'll get a dispensation so that you can marry at Saint-Paul. It's a better church. It was built by the Jesuits. It's smarter. It's just opposite the Cardinal de Berregui fountain. The masterpiece of Jesuit architecture is in Namur, a place called Saint-Loup. You must go there when you're married. It's worth the trip. Mademoiselle, I am entirely on your side. I want girls to marry. They're made for it. There is a certain St. Catherine that I'd like to see with her hair down. To stay a maid is all very well, but it's chilly. The Bible says, go and multiply. To save the people, you need Joan of Arc, but to make the people, you need a Mère Gigogne. So marry, you beauties. I really don't see the point of remaining a maid. I'm well aware there's a chapel set apart in church, and there's a lot of hot air about the sorority of the Virgin, but heavens above, a pretty husband, a brave boy, and after a year a big blonde nipper that sucks heartily on your nipples, one with nice rolls of fat on his thighs, that gropes and grabs fistfuls of your breast with his little pink paws, laughing like the dawn. Surely that's better than holding a candle at vespers and singing Turis Eburnea."
The grandfather did a pirouette on his 90-year-old heels and began to speak again, like a spring springing back.
"So, to stop the flow of your daydreams, I'll sip. It's true, then, in a little you'll be married. Speaking of which..."
"What, father?"
"Didn't you have a close friend?"
"Yes, Courfeyrac."
"What's happened to him?"
"He died."
"That's just as well."
He sat beside them, made Cosette sit, and took their four hands in his old hands, gnarled as they were.
"She is exquisite, this little cutie. She is a masterpiece, this Cosette here. She is very much the ingenue, and very much the grande dame at once. She would only be a baroness, which is demeaning, for she was born a marquise. Now, those are what I call eyelashes for you. My children, get it into your thick noggins that this is for real. Love one another. Be silly with love. Love is mankind's silliness and God's wit. Adore one another. Only,"
he added, all at once darkening,
"what a sorry state of affairs, now that I think about it. More than half of what I have is in a life annuity. While I'm alive, that'll hold out all right, but after my death, you won't get a sou. Your beautiful white hands, Madame la Baronne, will have the honor of scraping and saving to make ends meet."
Here, a grave and tranquil voice was heard to say, "Mademoiselle Euphrasie Fauchelevent has 600,000 francs. It was the voice of Jean Valjean. He had not yet uttered a word. No one seemed to realize he was still there, standing as he was, straight and motionless, behind all these happy people.
"Who is the Mademoiselle Euphrasie in question?"
asked the grandfather, alarmed.
"I am," answered Cosette.
600,000 francs, replied Monsieur Gillenormand.
"Less 14,000 or 15,000 francs, perhaps," said Jean Valjean. And he placed on the table the packet that Aunt Gillenormand had mistaken for a book. Jean Valjean himself opened the packet. It was a bundle of banknotes. They flicked through them and counted them. There were 500 notes of 1,000 francs,
and 168 of 500, in all 584,000 francs.
Now, there's a good book for you, said Monsieur Gillenormand.
584,000 francs, murmured the aunt.
This arranges things pretty nicely, isn't that so, Mademoiselle Gillenormand the elder?
The grandfather crowed.
That little devil Marius, he's plucked a millionaire grisette for you from off the tree of dreams. So now you can trust in young people's love affairs. Male students find female students worth 600,000 francs. Cherubino does better than Rothschild.
584,000 francs, Mademoiselle Gillenormand repeated in a hushed voice. 584,000 francs? You might as well say 600,000 while you're at it.
As for Marius and Cosette, they gazed at each other the whole time and paid scant attention to this tiny detail. You are better off putting your money in a certain forest than leaving it with a certain notary. You will no doubt have realized, without having to be told at length, that after the Champmathieu affair, Jean Valjean had made it to Paris, thanks to the initial escape that lasted a few days, and to withdraw in time from Lafitte's the sum earned by him under the name of Monsieur Madeleine at Montreuil-sur-Mer, and that fearing recapture, which in fact was only a little while off, he had hidden and buried this sum in the forest of Montfermeil in the place known as the Blaru grounds. The sum, 630,000 francs, all in banknotes, did not take up much space and was contained in only one box. To preserve the box from damp, he had put it inside an oak casket full of chestnut shavings. In the same casket he had put his other treasure, the bishop's candlesticks. You will recall that he had carried off the candlesticks when he escaped from Montreuil-sur-Mer. The man spotted one night by Boulatruelle was Jean Valjean. Later, whenever Jean Valjean needed money, he came and got some in the Blaru glade. Hence the absences we have mentioned. He had a pick somewhere among the briars in a hiding place he alone knew about. When he saw that Marius was getting better, feeling that the time was coming when the money might be useful, he had gone and got it, and it was him again whom Boulatruelle had seen in the woods, but this time in the morning, not at night. Boulatruelle inherited the pickaxe. The real sum was 584,500 francs. Jean Valjean kept the 500 francs for himself. We'll see what happens later, he said. The difference between this sum and the 630,000 francs withdrawn from Lafitte's represented 10 years' expenses, from 1823 to 1833. The 5 years' stay in the convent had only cost 5,000 francs. Jean Valjean put the two silver candlesticks on the mantelpiece, where they shone to Toussaint's great admiration. On top of this, Jean Valjean knew that he had been delivered from Javert. It had been mentioned in his hearing, and he had confirmed the fact in the Moniteur, which had published it, that a police inspector named Javert had been found drowned under a washerwoman's boat between the Pont au Change and the Pont Neuf, and that a note left by this man, otherwise irreproachable and highly esteemed by his chiefs, indicated that he had committed suicide in a bout of insanity. In actual fact, thought Jean Valjean, since he had me there and yet let me go, he must have been mad already. The two old men do all they can, each in his own way, to see that Cosette is happy. The wedding preparations were all underway. The doctor was consulted and declared that it could take place in February. This was in December. A few blissful weeks of perfect happiness rolled by. The grandfather was far from being the least happy. He would sit gazing at Cosette for a quarter of an hour at a stretch.
"What an outrageously pretty girl!" he would cry. "And she looks so sweet and so good. No need to say cross my heart and hope to die. This is the loveliest girl I've ever seen in my life. Later on, she'll be as virtuous as can be, with a whiff of violets about her. She is grace itself, don't you know? You couldn't help but live nobly with such a creature. Marius, my boy, you are a baron. You are rich. Stop this pettifogging, I beseech you." Cosette and Marius had suddenly stepped out of the sepulchre
and into paradise. The transition had been pretty abrupt, and they would have been dazed had they not been dazzled. "Can you make head or tail of it?" Marius said to Cosette. "No," Cosette answered. "But it seems to me the good Lord is looking down on us." Jean Valjean did everything, smoothed everything, reconciled everything, made everything easy. He rushed toward Cosette's happiness with as much eagerness and apparent joy as Cosette herself. As he had been a mayor, he knew how to resolve a delicate problem that he alone was in on the secret of, Cosette's civil status. To baldly state her origins, who knows, it might well have prevented the marriage. He got Cosette out of all difficulties, though. He arranged a whole family of dead people for her, a sure way of not incurring any untoward claim. Cosette was all that remained of an otherwise extinct family. She was not his own daughter, but the daughter of a different Fauchelevent. Two Fauchelevent brothers had been gardeners at the Petit Picpus convent. They went to the convent. The best information and the most respectable testimonials abounded. The good sisters had little aptitude or inclination for delving into questions of paternity, and without meaning any harm had never really known exactly which of the two Fauchelevent little Cosette was the daughter of. They said what they were required to say, and said it with gusto. A notary's affidavit was drawn up. Cosette became Mademoiselle Euphrasie Fauchelevent before the law. She was declared an orphan on both her father's and her mother's sides. Jean Valjean engineered things so that he was designated Cosette's guardian, under the name of Fauchelevent, with Monsieur Gillenormand as surrogate guardian. As for the 584,000 francs, this was a legacy left to Cosette by a dead person who wished to remain anonymous. The original legacy had been 594,000 francs, but 10,000 francs had been spent on the education of Mademoiselle Euphrasie, of which 5,000 had been paid to the convent itself. This legacy, deposited in the hands of a third party, was to be handed to Cosette when she came of age or when she married. Altogether, this arrangement was most acceptable, as we see, especially with an extra income of over 500,000. There were, in fact, a few disparities here and there, but nobody saw them. One of the interested parties had his eyes blindfolded by love, the others by the 600,000 francs. Cosette learned that she was not the daughter of a man she had so long called father. He was merely a relation. A different Fauchelevent was her real father. At any other time, this would have devastated her. But at this ineffably wonderful moment in her life, the news was just a patch of shadow, a small dark cloud. And she felt so much joy that the cloud soon dissolved. She had Marius. The young man surged to the fore, the old man faded into the background. Such is life. And then Cosette had been accustomed to finding herself surrounded by unanswered questions for many a long year. Anyone who has had a mysterious childhood is always ready to give certain things up. But she continued to call Jean Valjean father. In her rapture, Cosette was wild about old Gillenormand. It is true that he showered her with compliments and gifts. While Jean Valjean was busy building a normal place for Cosette in society and possession of an unassailable status, Monsieur Gillenormand saw to the wedding presents. Nothing amused him like being extravagantly generous. He had given Cosette a dress of Binche Guipure lace, which had come down to him from his very own grandmother.
"This is back in fashion again," he said. "Vintage clothes are all the rage, and the young women of my dotage dress like the old women of my childhood."
He rummaged through his respectable, pot-bellied Coromandel lacquer chests of drawers, which had not been opened in years.
"Let's get these old dowagers to cough up," he said. "Let's see what they've got in their paunches."
He noisily violated bulging drawers full of the outfits of all his wives, all his mistresses, all his grandmothers. Pekins, damasks, lampasses, painted moirés, gowns of gros de tour flambé damask, handkerchiefs from India embroidered with a washable gold, bits of reversible silk velvets known as dauphines, bobbin-made point de gêne lace, and needle-made point d'alençon lace, sets of jewels in old gold plate and silver plate, ivory sweet boxes decorated with microscopic battles, frippery, ribbons. He lavished the lot on Cosette. Cosette, marveling, frantic with love for Marius, and wild with gratitude for Monsieur Gillenormand, dreamed of boundless happiness decked out in satin and velvet. Her stock of wedding presents appeared to her held aloft by seraphim, her soul reeled off into the blue on wings of Mechlin lace. The intoxication of the lovers, we say again, was equalled only by the ecstasy of the grandfather. It was as though there was a brass band playing in the Rue des Filles du Calvaire. Every morning, a new offering of bric-a-brac from the grandfather to Cosette. All possible frills and flounces bloomed splendidly around her. One day, Marius, who was given to talking seriously in the midst of his happiness, said, apropos who knows what incident, "The men of the revolution are so great, they already have the luster of the centuries, like Cato and Phocion, and every one of them already seems like a figure of antiquity."
"Antique moire!" cried the old man. "Thank you, Marius, that's exactly what I was after."
And the next day, a magnificent gown of antique moire, the color of tea, was added to Cosette's stock of wedding presents. The grandfather derived wisdom from these fine confections.
"Love is all very well, but you need this with it. You need the useless for happiness. Happiness is only the bare necessity. Season it for me with a good pinch of the superfluous. A palace and her heart and the Louvre, her heart and the great fountains of Versailles. Give me my shepherdess, but try and see to it that she's a duchesse with it. Bring me Phyllis crowned with cornflowers and throw in 100,000 francs a year while you're at it. Show me a pastoral scene as far as the eye can see from under a colonnade of marble. I go along with the pastoral and with the fairyland enchantment of marble and gold, too. Plain, unadulterated happiness is like plain, unadulterated bread. You eat, but you don't dine. I want the superfluous, the useless, the extravagant, the too much, something that serves no purpose at all. I remember seeing in Strasbourg Cathedral a clock as tall as a three-story house that marked the hour. That was good enough to mark the hour, but that didn't look as though it was made for the task. For after striking midday or midnight, midday the hour of sun, midnight the hour of love, or any other hour you please, it gave you the moon and the stars, the earth and the sea, the birds and the fish, Phoebus and Phoebe, and a swarm of things that popped out of a niche, and the 12 apostles, and the Emperor Charles V, and Eponine and Sabinus, and a host of little gilded chaps that played the trumpet to boot, not counting the ravishing chimes that it scattered into the air all the time without anyone knowing why. Can a paltry, bare dial that merely tells the time compete with that? Myself, I side with the great clock of Strasbourg, and I prefer it to the cuckoo clock of the Black Forest any day."
Monsieur Gillenormand raved most especially about the wedding, and all the Louis XV vaudeville routines of the 18th century passed willy-nilly into his panegyrics.
"You don't know anything about the art of fêtes. You don't know how to put on a really wonderful celebration these days," he cried. "This 19th century of yours has no gumption. It lacks excess. It knows nothing about what is rich. It knows nothing about what is noble. In all things it is so tight-fisted. Your third estate is insipid, colourless, odourless, and shapeless. What your bourgeois who are staring out, as they say, dream of. A pretty boudoir freshly decorated, rosewood and calico. Make way! Make way! Old Grigou is marrying old maid Gripsou, that skinflint. Talk about sumptuousness and splendor. They have stuck a gold louis to a candle. There you have the age in a nutshell. I ask only to run away beyond the Sarmatians. As early as 1787, I foresaw that all was lost the day I saw the Duc de Rohan, Prince de Léon, Duc de Chabot, Duc de Montbazon, Marquis de Soubise, Vicomte de Tours, Peer of France, trot off to Longchamp in a bone-shaker. See what fruit it has borne. In this century, they wheel and deal, they play the stock exchange, they earn money, and they are stingy. They polish and varnish the surface, they are all turned out immaculately, washed, soaped, raked, shaved, combed, waxed, smoothed down, rubbed, brushed, cleaned outwardly, irreproachable, polished like a pebble, discreet, neat and tidy, and at the same time, by my true love's virtue, if they don't have dung heaps and cesspits at the bottom of their consciences that'd make a cowgirl that blows her nose with her fingers step back in horror. I grant these times this motto, dirty cleanliness. Marius, don't get annoyed, let me have my say. I'm not bad-mouthing the people, you see. I can't stop talking about this people of yours, but don't mind me if I give the bourgeoisie a bit of pummeling.
I'm part of it. Who loves well, lashes well. On that note, I say quite frankly, nowadays people marry, but they no longer know how to marry. Ah, it's true, I miss the nicety of the old ways. I miss everything about them. The elegance, the chivalry, the charming courtly manners, the delightful luxury everyone went in for, the way music was part of the wedding, symphony at the top, drumming at the bottom, the dances, the joyful faces around the table, the convoluted madrigals, the songs, the crackers, the belly laughs, every man and his dog there, the ribbons tied in big bows. I miss the bride's garter. The bride's garter is the cousin of the chastity belt. What does the Trojan War turn on? Helen's garter, by Jove! What are they fighting for? Why does the divine Diomedes smash that great bronze helmet with its 10 points over Meriones' head? Why do Achilles and Hector paint each other all over with fine strokes of the pick? Because Helen let Paris take her garter. With Cosette's garter, Homer would have made the Iliad. He'd stick an old chatterbox like me in his poem, and he'd call him Nestor. My friends in the old days, in the good old days, they knew how to marry. They'd have a good, solid contract, and after that, a good, solid spread.
As soon as Cujas went out, Gamache came in.
But, heavens, that's because the stomach is an agreeable animal that demands its due and wants its wedding, too. You dined well, and you had at your table a beautiful neighbor without a chemisette who didn't mind showing a bit of cleavage. Oh, the wide laughing mouths! How gay we were in those days! Youth was a bouquet. Every young man ended in a branch of lilac or a bunch of roses. Even if you were a warrior, you were a shepherd. And if by chance you were a captain of dragoons, you'd find a way of being called Florian. We were keen to be pretty. We embellished ourselves. We decked ourselves out in crimson. A bourgeois looked like a flower. A marquis looked like a gem. We didn't have stirrups. We didn't have boots. We were spruce, glossy, iridescent, brushed with gold, all aflutter, dapper, dashing. But that did not stop you from having your sword by your side. A hummingbird, beak and claws. Those were the days of Rameau's Lazan Gallant. One side of the century was its delicacy, the other its magnificence. And, saints above, we had fun! Today they're so serious! The bourgeois is a miser, his wife is a prude, your century is dire. They'd chase away the graces for flashing too much bosom. Alas, they hide beauty as though it were ugly. Since the revolution, everyone's been wearing pants, even the dancing girls. A strolling player must be grave, your rigadoons are doctrinaire. A person has to be stately. You would be most annoyed not to have your chin in your cravat. The ideal of some twerp of 20 about to marry is to be like Monsieur Royer Collard. And do you know what the world's coming to with that kind of stateliness? To being small. Listen and learn. Joy is not only joyful, it is big. So be in love with gusto, for God's sake. So get married, when you marry, with all the fever and giddiness and uproar and mayhem of happiness. Gravity at church, fair enough. But as soon as Mass is over, damn it, the new bride must be surrounded by a swirling dream. A wedding should be royal and fabulous. It should take its ceremony for a stroll from the Cathedral of Reims to the Pagoda of Chanteloupe. I can't stand a half-hearted wedding. For pity's sake, be on Olympus. At least that day. Be gods. Ah, you could be sylphs. Those divinities, the pleasures, are Geraspides, and yet you are gutless wonders. My friends, every new bridegroom should be a Prince Aldobrandini. Take advantage of this 1 minute of your life to soar off into the Empyrean with the swans and the eagles, even if it means dropping back down into the bourgeois world of frogs the next day. Don't stint on the bonds of marriage. Don't cut back on its splendors. Don't skimp on the one day you are to shine. A wedding is not housework. Oh, if I had my way, it would be gallantly chic. You would hear violins in the trees. This is how I see it. Sky blue and silver. I would bring the rustic divinities into the fete. I would summon the dryads and the nereids. The sea goddess Amphitrite's wedding day. A pink cloud. Nymphs with tremendous hairdos, but otherwise completely naked. A member of the Académie offering the goddess quatrains. A chariot drawn by sea monsters. Triton trotted ahead, and from his conch he drew sounds so ravishing he ravished young and old, too. Now, That's a proper program for a fete for you. Or I'm a Dutchman, by jingo.
While the grandfather was in full lyrical flight, enjoying the sound of his own voice, Cosette and Marius were practically swooning in intoxication, now that they could gulp each other in freely by gazing. Aunt Gillenormand studied all this with her unflappable placidity. She had had a certain dose of emotion in the space of 5 or 6 months. Marius back home, Marius carried back home covered in blood, Marius carried back home from some barricade, Marius dead, then alive, Marius reconciled, Marius engaged, Marius about to marry a pauper, Marius about to marry a millionaire. The 600,000 francs had been her latest surprise. Then she reverted to her usual indifference, the lack of interest of a first communicant. She regularly went to church services, said her rosary, read her prayer book, which she called a eucologion, whispered aves in one corner of the house while they were whispering I love yous in the other, looked on Marius and Cosette as two shadows. She was the shadow. There is a certain state of inert asceticism in which the soul, neutralized by torpor, foreign to what might be called the business of living, does not pick up any human impressions, whether pleasant or painful, with the exception of earthquakes and other disasters.
This kind of devoutness, said old Gillenormand to his daughter, corresponds to a head cold. You can't smell anything of life. No bad odor, but also no good.
Still, the 600,000 francs had taken care of the old maid's indecision. Her father had acquired the habit of taking so little account of her that he had not consulted her when consenting to Marius's marriage. He had acted impetuously, as was his wont, having only one thought, now that he had gone from being a despot to being a slave, and that was to make Marius happy. As for the lad's aunt, that aunt should exist, and that she might have an opinion was not something he had considered for a moment, and though she was as docile as a lamb, this had hurt her feelings. A tad rebellious deep within, though unruffable without, she had said to herself, "My father has settled the question of the marriage without me. I will settle the question of the inheritance without him." She, in fact, was rich, and the father was not. And so she reserved her decision on that score. It is likely that if it had been a poor match, she would have left it poor. Too bad for Monsieur, my nephew. If he wants to marry a beggar, let him be a beggar himself. But Cosette's 500,000 tickled the aunt and changed her position in regard to this particular pair of lovers. A person owes 600,000 francs some consideration, and it was obvious that she could not do otherwise than to leave her fortune to these young people, since they no longer needed it. It was arranged that the couple would live at the grandfather's. Monsieur Gillenormand absolutely insisted on giving them his room, the nicest in the house.
"It will rejuvenate me," he declared. "It is an old scheme of mine. I always plan to liven up my room."
He filled the room with a swag of old gentlemanly knick-knacks. He had a new ceiling put up and hung with an extraordinary fabric he happened to have a bolt of, and which he thought was from Utrecht, velvet bear's ear flowers on a satiny, buttercup-yellow background.
"It was with some of this fabric," he said, "that the bed of the Duchesse d'Anville was draped at La Roche-Guyon."
On the mantelpiece he planted a Saxony figurine, holding a muff over her bare stomach. Monsieur Gillenormand's library became the attorney's chambers Marius needed. Chambers, you will remember, being required by the rules of the order. Dream effects fusing into happiness. The lovers saw each other every day. Cosette came along with Monsieur Fauchelevent. "It's doing things the wrong way around," said Mademoiselle Gillenormand, "for the intended to come to the groom's home and be courted like this." But Marius's convalescence had become a habit, and the Rue des Filles du Calvaire armchairs, better for tête-à-tête than the straw-bottomed chairs of the Rue de l'Homme Armé, had firmly established it. Marius and Monsieur Fauchelevent saw each other but did not speak to each other. It seemed that this was some sort of agreement. Every girl needs a chaperone. Cosette would not have been able to come without Monsieur Fauchelevent. For Marius, Monsieur Fauchelevent was the condition on which he saw Cosette. He accepted him. by bringing up certain political questions, vaguely and without going into particulars, to do with the general improvement in everyone's lot, they managed to say a bit more than yes or no to each other. Once, on the subject of education, which Malus thought should be free and compulsory, spread far and wide in all its forms, lavished on all like the air and the sun, in a word, breathable by the whole population, they were in complete agreement and almost chatted. Malus noticed on that occasion that Monsieur Fauchelevent spoke well, and even with a certain linguistic flair. Yet he was lacking some indefinable quality. Monsieur Fauchelevent was something less than a man of the world, and something more. Inwardly, and at the back of his mind, Marius surrounded this Monsieur Fauchelevent, who was to him simply benevolent and cold, with all sorts of silent questions. At times he had doubts about his own memories. There was a hole in his memory, a black spot, an abyss, hollowed out by 4 months at death's door. Many things had gotten lost down it. He had even got to the point of wondering if it was really true that he had seen Monsieur Fauchelevent, such a serious and calm man, at the barricade. And this was not the only blank spot that the comings and goings of the past had left in his mind. It would be wrong to think that he was freed from all those obsessions of memory that force us, even when we are happy, even when we are satisfied, to look back in melancholy. The head that does not turn round toward horizons that have vanished can neither think nor love. At times, Malus covered his face with his hands, and the vague but tumultuous past would travel across the dim twilight in his brain. He saw Mabeuf fall again. He heard Gavroche sing under the grape shot. He felt the coldness of Éponine's forehead against his lips. Enjolras, Courfeyrac, Jean Prouvaire, Combeferre, Bossuet, Grantaire, all his friends rose before him, then evaporated. All these beloved beings, sorrowful, valiant, charming, or tragic, were they dreams? Had they actually existed? The riot had wreathed everything in its smoke. Those great fevers produce great dreams. He questioned himself, he patted himself down. He was dizzy from all those vanished realities. Where had they all gone? Was it really true that they were all dead? A tumble in the dark had carried all away except for him. All that seemed to him to have disappeared as though behind a theatre curtain. Curtains do come down like that on life. God skips to the next act. And what about him? Was he actually the same man? He, the pauper, was rich. He, the abandoned, had a family. He, the hopeless, was marrying Cosette. He felt like he had been through a tomb, going in black and coming out white. But the others had stayed there. At certain moments, all these creatures from the past came back from the dead and formed a ring around him and cast a shadow over him like a dark cloud. Then he would think of Cosette, and he became serene once more, but nothing less than this felicity was needed to erase that catastrophe. Monsieur Fauchelevent very nearly had a place among those vanished beings. Marius found it hard to believe that the Fauchelevent of the barricade was the same as this Fauchelevent of flesh and blood, so gravely seated by Cosette's side. The first was probably one of those nightmares that came and went during his hours of delirium. In any case, both of them being unapproachable, there was no way Marius could put a question of any kind to Monsieur Fauchelevent. The idea did not even occur to him. We have already pointed out this typical detail. For two men to have a common secret, yet through a sort of tacit agreement not exchange a single word on the subject, is not as rare as you might think. Only once did Marius make an attempt of the kind. Bringing up the Rue de la Chanvrerie in conversation, he turned to Monsieur Fauchelevent and asked him, "You know the street well, don't you?" "What street?" "The Rue de la Chanvrerie." "I have no idea what the name of the street is," answered Monsieur Fauchelevent in the most natural tone in the world. The answer, which had to do with the name of the street and not the street itself, appeared to Marius more conclusive than it was. "Obviously," he thought, "I must have been dreaming. I must have had a hallucination. It's someone who looks like him." Monsieur Fauchelevent was not there. Two men who can't be found. The enchantment, great as it was, did not wipe other preoccupations from Marius's mind. While the wedding was gearing up and while waiting for the agreed-upon day to arrive, he had some tricky and thorough retrospective investigations carried out. He owed gratitude on several sides. He owed some to his father. He owed some to himself. There was Thénardier. There was the unknown man who had brought him, Marius, back to Monsieur Gillenormand's. Marius was keen to find these two men, not intending to marry, be happy, and forget them, and fearing that these debts of duty, if unpaid, would cast a shadow over his life, so luminous now. He was not the sort of person who could leave all these arrears overdue behind him, and he wanted, before joyfully embarking on the future, to have paid the past's bill. That Thénardier was a scoundrel in no way detracted from the fact that he had saved Colonel Pontmercy's life. Thénardier was a crook to everyone else but Marius, and Marius, knowing nothing about what really happened on the battlefield of Waterloo, did not know this specific fact, which was that his father was, in relation to Thénardier, in the strange situation of owing the man his life without owing him gratitude. None of the sundry agents Marius employed managed to pick up Thénardier's scent. All traces seemed to have been obliterated on that side. Mother Thénardier had died in prison during the preliminary inquiry, pending trial. Thénardier and his daughter Azelma, the two sole survivors of the woeful clan, had melted back into the shadows. The fathomless pit of the social unknown had silently closed over those beings. You could no longer even see on the surface that quivering and trembling, those faint concentric circles that announce that something has fallen in and that a probe might be thrown in after them. With Mother Thénardier dead, Boulatruelle out of harm's way, Claquesous vanished into thin air, the principal accused broken out of jail, the legal proceedings relating to the ambush in the Gorbeau slum had more or less aborted. The affair had been left up in the air. The bench of the circuit court had had to make do with two underlings, Panchaud, alias Printanier, alias Bigrenaille, and Demilliard, alias Dumilliard, who had been sentenced in the presence of the parties involved to 10 years in the galleys. A verdict of hard labor in perpetuity had been delivered against their accomplices, who had escaped and did not appear. Thénardier, chief and ringleader, had been sentenced to death, also in absentia. This sentence was the only thing left of Thénardier, casting its sinister glow on his buried name like a candle next to a bier. Besides, by causing Thénardier to dive back down into the lowest depths for fear of being seized again, the sentence only added to the thick layer of murk that covered the man. As for the other one, the unidentified stranger who had saved Marius's life, the investigation initially yielded some results, then stalled. They managed to find the fiacre that had brought Marius back to the Rue des Filles du Calvaire on the night of June 6th. The driver declared that on June 6th, according to a police officer's orders, he had parked from 3 o'clock in the afternoon till nightfall on the Quai des Champs-Élysées, above the outlet of the Grand Sewer, that at around 9 o'clock in the evening, the sewer gate that opens onto the riverbank had opened, that a man had emerged from it, carrying on his shoulders another man who looked to be dead, that on the officer's orders, he, the driver, had accommodated all those people in his fiacre, that they had first gone to the Rue des Filles du Calvaire, that they had put the dead man down there, that was Monsieur Marius, that he, the driver, recognized him perfectly, even though he was alive this time round, that after that they had got back in his cab, that he had whipped his horses, that a few feet from the Porte des Archives they'd shouted at him to stop, that there in the street they had paid him and left him, and that the officer had taken the other man with him, that he did not know anything more, that it had been a very dark night. Marius, as we said, remembered nothing. He only remembered being grabbed from behind by a very strong hand just as he was falling backward into the barricade. Then everything was a blank. He had only recovered consciousness at Monsieur Gillenormand's. He got bogged down in conjectures. He could not doubt his own identity. Yet how come, having fallen in the Rue de la Chanvrerie, he had been picked up by the police officer on the bank of the Seine near the Pont des Invalides? Somebody had carried him from Les Halles, Cartier, to the Champs-Élysées. How? Through the sewer. Unheard-of devotion.
Somebody?
Who? It was this man that Marius was looking for. Of this man who was his savior, nothing, not a trace, not the slightest sign. Although forced to tread very carefully here, Marius pushed his investigation as far as the prefecture of police. There the information obtained did not lead to any enlightenment any more than elsewhere. The prefecture knew less than the cab driver. They were not aware of any arrest carried out on June 6th at the gate of the Grand Sewer. They had received no officer's report about such an action, which at the prefecture was regarded as a fable they attributed to the driver. A driver looking for a tip is capable of anything, even of imagination. The action had definitely happened, though, and Marius could not doubt it unless he doubted his own identity, as we were saying a moment ago. Everything in this strange puzzle was inexplicable. The man, the mystery man, who the driver had seen coming out of the gate of the Grand Sewer carrying the unconscious Marius on his back, and whom the police officer on the lookout had arrested in the act of rescuing an insurgent, what had become of him? What had become of the officer himself? Why had this officer maintained his silence? Had the man succeeded in escaping? Had he bribed the officer? Why didn't the man give Marius some sign of life when Marius was in his eternal debt? The man's disinterestedness was no less staggering than his devotion. Why didn't the man reappear? Maybe he was above a reward, but no one is above gratitude. Was he dead? What sort of man was he? What did he look like? No one could say. The driver answered, "It was a very dark night." Basque and Nicolette, flabbergasted, had been riveted by their young master all covered in blood. The porter, whose candle had shed light on the tragic arrival of Marius, was alone in noticing the man in question, but the only description he gave of him was this. The man was awful. In the hope of making use of them in his investigations, Marius had had preserved the blood-stained clothes he had on when he had been brought home to his grandfather's. On examining the coat, it was noticed that there was an odd tear. A bit was missing. One evening, Marius was talking in front of Cosette and Jean Valjean about the whole peculiar episode, of the endless information he had gathered, and the pointlessness of his efforts. The stony face of Monsieur Fauchelevent irritated him. He cried out with a vehemence that almost had the ringing tone of anger, "Yes, that man, whoever he is, was sublime. Do you know what he did, monsieur? He intervened like the archangel. He would have had to hurl himself into the middle of the fray, steal me away, open up the sewer, drag me down into it, carry me through it. He would have had to go more than a league and a half through hideous underground tunnels, bent over, buckled under, in the dark, in the cesspool, more than a league and a half, monsieur, with a corpse on his back. And with what aim? With the single aim of saving the corpse. And the corpse was me. He said to himself, 'There is perhaps a glimmer of life in there yet. I'm going to risk my own existence for that miserable spark.' And his existence, he didn't just risk it once, but 20 times. And every step of the way was dangerous. The proof is that when he came out of the sewer, he was arrested. Did you know, monsieur, that this man did all that? And with no reward waiting for him. What was I? An insurgent? What was I? One of the defeated? Oh, if Cosette's 600,000 francs were mine—"
"They are yours,"
Jean Valjean cut in.
"Well then," Marius resumed, "I would give them all to find that man."
Jean Valjean said nothing.
Book 6. A Sleepless Night. February 16th, 1833. The night of the 16th of February, 1833, was a blessed night. Above its shadow sat the open sky. It was Marius and Cosette's wedding night. The day had been wonderful. It had not been the sky-blue fate of the grandfather's dreams, a spectacular fairyland with a welter of cherubs and cupids over the married couple's heads, a wedding worthy of featuring in a frieze above a door, but it had been sweet and happy. The fashion for weddings in 1833 was not what it is today. France had not yet borrowed from England the supreme refinement of abducting your wife, running off as soon as you are out the church door, hiding your happiness in shame, and generally behaving like a bankrupt, emulating the ravishment portrayed in the Song of Songs. They had not yet realized how terribly chaste, exquisite, and decent it is to go bumping your taste of paradise about in a post-chaise, to chop your secret pleasure up with clickety-clacks, to take a bed in an inn as the nuptial bed, and leave behind, in the banal alcove at so much a night, the most sacred of life's memories all jumbled up indiscriminately with the tête-à-tête you had with the stagecoach driver and the servant at the inn. In this second half of the 19th century in which we live, the mayor and his sash, the priest and his chasuble, the law and God are no longer enough. We have to top them up with the long jumeau postillion, blue jacket with red lapels and bell-shaped buttons, badge worn as an armband, green leather breeches, curses directed at Norman horses with knotted tails, imitation galloons, oilskin hat, big powdered hair, enormous whip and sturdy boots. France has not yet carried elegance as far as the English nobility, who shower down-at-the-heel slippers and old worn-out shoes on the married couples post-barouche in memory of Churchill, later Marlborough or Malbrook, who was assailed on his wedding day by the wrath of an aunt that brought him luck. The old shoes and the slippers are not yet part of our nuptial celebrations, but patience. With good taste continuing to spread, we will get there. In 1833, 100 years ago, the act of marriage was not performed at a brisk trot. They still imagined, in those days, oddly enough, that a wedding was an intimate social fete, that a patriarchal banquet did not spoil the domestic solemnity, that gaiety, even when excessive, provided it remained decent, did not hurt happiness, and that, in the end, it was noble and good that the fusion of two destinies from which a family would emerge should begin at home, and that the nuptial chamber should be a witness from that moment on to the union. And they had the cheek to marry at home. The wedding reception took place then, after this now outdated fashion, at Monsieur Gillenormand's. As natural and normal as the business of marrying may be, there is always some complication with the banns to be published, the acts to be drawn up, the mairie, the church. They could not be ready before February 16th. Now, we note this detail for the sheer satisfaction of being precise. It so happened that February 16th was a Mardi Gras, Shrove Tuesday. Hesitations, scruples, particularly on the part of Aunt Gillenormand. "A Mardi Gras!" cried the grandfather. "So much the better. There is a proverb. A Mardi Gras wedding match, and you'll avoid ungrateful brats." "Let's carry on regardless. The 16th it is. You don't want to put it back, do you, Marius?"
"No, of course not," replied the lover.
"Let's get married, then," said the grandfather. And so the wedding took place on the 16th, notwithstanding the public festivities. It rained that day, but there is always a little pocket of blue in the sky at the service of happiness, which lovers see even when the rest of creation is huddled under an umbrella. The night before, Jean Valjean had handed Marius the 584,000 francs in the presence of Monsieur Gillenormand. The marriage being based on joint ownership of property, the acts were straightforward. Toussaint was now of no use to Jean Valjean. Cosette had inherited her and had promoted her to the rank of lady's maid. As for Jean Valjean, there was in the Gillenormand house a lovely room done up just for him. And Cosette had said to him so irresistibly,
"Father, please, I implore you,"
that she had more or less got him to promise he would come and live in it. A few days before the day fixed for the wedding, Jean Valjean had had an accident. He had injured his right thumb. It was not serious, and he would not allow anyone to look at it, or bandage it, or even to see that he was in pain, not even Cosette. But it had forced him, nonetheless, to wrap up his hand in some linen and to wear his arm in a sling, and so had prevented him from signing anything. Monsieur Gillenormand, as Cosette's surrogate guardian, had stood in for him. We will not take the reader either to the mairie or to the church. It is not done to follow two lovers as far as that, the usual practice being to turn one's back to the drama as soon as a bridegroom's sprig is safely in its buttonhole. We will restrict ourselves to noting an incident that, although unnoticed by the wedding party,
marked the trip from the Rue des Filles du Calvaire to the Church of Saint-Paul. At the time, the north end of the Rue Saint-Louis was being repaved. It was cordoned off from the Rue du Parc Royal on. This meant it was impossible for the two wedding cars to go directly to Saint-Paul's. There was no choice but to change the itinerary, and the simplest thing to do was to turn off at the boulevard. One of the guests observed that it was Mardi Gras and that the place would be packed with carriages there.
"Why?" asked Monsieur Gillenormand.
"Because of the masks."
"Splendid," said the grandfather. "Let's go that way. These young people are getting married. They're about to enter the serious business of life. Getting a look at a bit of a masquerade will set them up nicely."
They took the boulevard. The first of the wedding berlins contained Cosette and Aunt Gillenormand, Monsieur Gillenormand and Jean Valjean. Marius, still kept apart from his fiancée, according to custom, came only in the second. The nuptial cortège, on leaving the Rue des Filles du Calvaire, joined the long procession of carriages that formed an endless chain from the Madeleine to the Bastille and from the Bastille to the Madeleine. Masks were to be seen all over the boulevard. It could rain all it liked, as often as it liked. Payas, Pantaloon, and Gilles were not about to call it a day. In the good-humoured atmosphere of the winter of 1833, Paris had disguised itself as Venice. You don't see Mardi Gras like that anymore. All that exists now being one great carnival, there is no carnival anymore. The side alleys were choked with people out and about, and windows were crammed with the curious. The loggias that crowned the peristyles of the theatres were overflowing with onlookers. Apart from the masks, they were lapping up the parade, peculiar to Mardi Gras and Longchamp, of vehicles of all kinds. Fiacres, citadines, covered with brakes known as tapissières, charabancs, carrioles, gigs, all rolling along in orderly fashion, rigorously hooked up to each other by police regulations as though running on rails. Anyone sitting in these vehicles is at once spectator and spectacle. Police constables on the sides of the boulevard were keeping these two interminable parallel lines moving in opposite directions and watching closely to ensure that nothing hampered the twin flow of the two streams of cars running upstream and downstream, either toward the Chaussée d'Antin or toward the Faubourg Saint-Antoine. The emblazoned carriages of the peers of France and the ambassadors stuck to the middle of the road, where they could come and go untrammeled. Certain magnificent and rowdy cortèges, notably the Fat Ox, the special model of a prize ox, enjoyed the same privilege. In this gay Paris, England cracked its whip. The post-chaise of Lord Seymour, harassed by a vulgar nickname, rolled along with much racket. In the double line, which municipal guards galloped up and down like sheepdogs, honest-to-goodness family Berlingot, loaded up with great-aunts and grandmothers, displayed at their doors clusters of fresh-faced children in disguise. 7-year-old Pierrots, 6-year-old Pierrettes, ravishing little creatures who, sensing that they were officially part of the public rejoicing, were pervaded by the dignity of the harlequinade and were as grave as public servants. From time to time a traffic jam occurred somewhere in the procession of vehicles, and one or the other of the two lines would stop just long enough for the knot to be disentangled. One carriage held up was enough to bring the whole line to a standstill. Then they would resume their course. The wedding coaches were in the line heading toward the Bastille and hugging the right side of the boulevard. Where the Rue du Pont aux Choux comes in, there was a halt. Almost at the same moment, on the other shoulder, the line going the other way toward the Madeleine also stopped. These cars, or to be more precise, these cartloads of masks, are only too familiar to Parisians. If they were missing from a Mardi Gras or a mid-Lent carnival, people would see something sinister in it, and they would say, "There's something behind this. The ministry's probably about to go." A heap of Cassandras, Harlequins, and Columbines, jigging past over the heads of the onlookers, every possible grotesque, from the Turk to the savage, Hercules ferrying marquises, fishwives who would make Rabelais block his ears just as the Maenads caused Aristophanes to lower his gaze, hemp wigs, pink costumes, loud swaggerers' hats, buffoonish glasses, pirates' cocked hats teased by butterflies, shouts hurled at pedestrians, hands on hips, brazen posturing, bare shoulders, masked faces, unfettered shamelessness. A chaotic profusion of effrontery driven about by a coach driver with flowers in his